Everyone, and welcome to the Wednesday, May 6th meeting of the Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. And I will begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3256. Jeremy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3256 provides that it is unlawful employment practice for employer to discriminate in specified actions against a person because of person's uniformed service, prohibits discrimination by a public employer denying employee rights or status provided in ORS Chapter 408 to veterans in public employment, or by denying initial employment, reemployment following leave taken for uniformed service, retention in employment, promotion, or any other term or condition of employment because a person applies, performs, or has performed in uniformed service, or discharging, expelling, disciplining, or threatening a person for exercising or attempting to exercise rights to participate in uniformed service. States that employer does not commit unlawful employment practice if the employer acted based on a bona fide occupational requirement reasonably necessary to normal operation of employer's business, and employer's actions could not have been avoided by reasonably accommodating a person's uniformed service. Provides that measure applies to conduct occurring on or after the effective date of the bill. It has no revenue impact, and there's been a fiscal statement issued that shows a slight possibility of a slight increase in claims through the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The House vote was 56 in favor.
Okay. Thank you, Jeremy. And we have several people signed up to testify, but I see that Greg Matthews, Representative Matthews, has joined us. So please come forward and introduce the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Matthews. I'm a state representative with the great city of Gresham, House District 50. And I'm here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 3256. This was a bill that, I'm very proud of the work that's been done with not only the Attorney General's office, but our military department and our Labor Commissioner, Brad Avakian, as well. The real issue for this bill came when we started to realize that we're going to have, 3,000 troops, all of which have started their deployment to Iraq. And a lot of those, given today's economy, are leaving pretty secure jobs. And to leave the jobs to serve the country, one would think that it's only right that they return to those same opportunities when they return from war. The problem is that we found out in looking at the Uniformed Service Employment and Reemployment Rights Act of 1994 that although it's an act that would encourage and actually kind of demands, it didn't have any state teeth to really enforce. And so the problem came as a result of, well, what do we do when that act is violated? How do we follow through with our veterans? You'll hear from several folks. I hope retired General Doctor is planning on testifying as well. There's a group, the Employer Support for the Guard and Reserve Program, that is working with a lot of our businesses to educate them on what these rights of our servicemen and women are. But the reality is that in the egregious case, we don't have a local component of enforcement. And so with the help of Attorney General John Kroger and, of course, our Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian, we're able to produce that through this bill. The one thing that I want to point out, too, is that this is probably more prominent, believe it or not, in the public sector where there's a problem than there is in the private industry. Our private employers do, I believe, an outstanding job. And I also believe that the folks that volunteer a great deal of their time for the employer support for the Guard and Reserve are able to do a great deal of mediation to get people into agreement. But in the cases where they can't reach agreement, and the case where our veterans are being impacted, we felt it necessary to create this component of enforcement. And so that's why the bill got brought forward, and that's why I'm proud to be sponsor of the bill. And I believe you'll hear from our Attorney General's office. Those folks have worked extremely hard, but also Brigadier General Caldwell as well, and hopefully retired General Doctor.
Great. Okay, thank you for bringing this to us. Any questions for Representative Matthews? Okay. Thank you very much. And you're welcome to stay with us, or if you have to be somewhere else.
I'm going to go to Consumer Protection, but I believe I'll be back.
Okay, great. And we have three more people signed up, and I think we'll call them all together. So we'll call Jim Willis, Dave Kramer, and Paul Evans. And actually, if you want to pull up an extra chair, that's fine. We have three chairs. Oh, I guess I thought four people were coming up.
We're good.
Sure. Okay, whoever would like to go first, please go ahead.
He has to leave at 3:30, so maybe better have him go first.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Paul Evans. I'm policy advisor on military and veterans affairs to Governor Kulongoski. And I must apologize at the beginning. I actually have to leave for a H1N1 discussion in a little while. But I wanted to start off real quick and emphasize that House Bill 3256, while it was not one of the bills put forward by the task force, it is one of the 39 recommendations that the task force came up with and would have been one of our bills had we had one more legislative concept to be able to put forward. It's a good bill. It's an important bill. And more importantly, it actually is, in my opinion anyway, more flexible and focused given the changing world of the National Guard and Reserve. The USERRA laws never imagined a universe where the National Guard and Reserve would be operationalized, meaning every 3 to 4 years, National Guard and Reservists would be called to active duty. The USERRA laws never really took into account some of the changing ways in which we employ people, contracts and contracted employees and things like that. What we believe is House Bill 3256 is an Oregon remedy to a real problem. I myself and my own National Guard unit actually have two public employees that are undergoing challenges because of their service, and in each particular issue, they're just around what USERRA can effectively fix, and there is not really an effective enforcement mechanism currently in place. The folks at the ESGR do a wonderful job educating employers. I actually believe most employers want to do the right thing, but there is that 1% of folks that just don't want to do the right thing, and we believe this tool will help motivate and will help protect the folks that are protecting us. If you have any questions, I'll try to answer.
Okay. I know you do have to leave, so are there any questions for this witness? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We'll let you go off to your other duties. Okay, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Kramer. I'm with the Attorney General's office. Attorney General Kroger asked me to come and testify today. I provided your committee with written testimony, and I'm happy to summarize the main points of that and also to answer any questions you might have or any of the members might have. Mr. Evans suggests, I know from my experience, and we know from experience working with various client agencies, that on occasion there are problems helping veterans recapture their employment rights in Oregon. Historically, that's a function of two things. Obviously, the great pressure that's on Guard and Reservists today is historically unique and creates financial pressure on them, but less obviously, perhaps, is that their employers are suffering from the same strain, the same pressures, and when we talk about the 97, 98, 99% of those employers who are doing the right thing, following federal law, we then leave the discussion at those remaining 1 or 2% who now have a competitive advantage in the workplace and the marketplace that they can use in a way that not only hurts the reservists but also hurts the economy. So the circumstances in today's point in climate for military people is unique, and I think our office would emphasize, as I think you'll hear time and again, that the efforts of, by and large, the majority of employers is superb, and by and large, the majority of veterans are taken care of either because of voluntary efforts or because of the contributions of our federal partners. But there is a gap in the process. Right now, as discussed in the testimony, the protections for Guard and Reservists are exclusively federal. There are some tangential laws that are described in there that does help Oregon Guards persons, but as discussed, the circumstances to which those apply are fairly limited. The aim of this particular proposal is to build into existing Oregon law a mechanism to protect those soldiers, sailors, and Marines and airmen. The idea conceptually is very simply to mirror in large part those federal protections But by mirroring them, you don't end up with redundant protections. What you end up with is an alternative forum, if you will, for those protections to be enforced. So instead of having to rely exclusively on our federal partners and our federal court system, by making these changes, aggrieved individuals can now turn to Oregon courts for assistance, and that would be unique. That would put military folks on par with a host of other class, the various classes of employees that are protected under Oregon law. And so the proposition basically is to consider those entitlements that already exist on the federal side to be important enough to protect under existing employment discrimination law in state court. I'll wrap it up now because I know you're busy and I know that the testimony is already prepared, but our vision and our hope is that by making this change in law that the Attorney General's office, working in partnership with ESGR, with BOLI, with all sorts of folks who are already at the table, that we can bring closure to these problems quicker, and that we can, in the process, educate the vast majority of well-intentioned employers so that the problems occur less often. So that's the fundamental concept. If the committee is interested, a number of experts here, obviously Mr. Willis, the director of ODVA, being one of them, but also General Caldwell's here, General Doctor is here. These folks and myself, to some extent, have all sorts of anecdotal information, if you're looking for that, in terms of how individuals are affected in this day and age. But for the large part, unless you have questions of me, I'll defer to them on those matters.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here in support of House Bill 3256. You also have my written testimony, so I'll just say just a couple of things. What I really like about 3256 is that it goes beyond the gross discrimination that is easily seen and dealt with to the more subtle issues such as threats, retaliation, or lack of promotion opportunities within government here in our state. And I see it sort of as a miniature USERRA protection at the state level, which I think was just very well articulated by the Attorney General's office. The other thing that strikes me that has changed in all of our lives is that our National Guard and Reserve have gone from being a strategic reserve to being an operational reserve. We are going to see, sadly, additional Oregon Guard personnel and Oregon Reserve personnel deployed beyond this brigade combat team that deployed over the weekend. So these 2,700 Oregonians that are gone are just a small representation of what may happen, certainly in the theater in Afghanistan, and whatever the additional needs may be in Iraq and in countries around the Middle East. So what we can do to assist these folks as they come back to reintegrate into not only the workforce but with their families and so on, we've got some good bills that we've dealt with that are dealing with some of the other issues. But I really want to pay tribute to the Employer Support, the Guard and Reserve, the Oregon Military Department, our Attorney General's Office, and our veterans organizations, and of course the people on my staff that have stepped up and all worked together to get to where we are today, Madam Chair, on House Bill 3256, and I would certainly ask for your consideration of this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay. Thank you both. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on House Bill 3256? Great. Come on forward.
And, Madam Chair, while he's coming up, you all have a copy of the FISCO in your packet, and you also have a letter from BOLI basically supporting this legislation.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, J. L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. Our employers ran this through our process, and I want to affirm that this is a bill that we are fine with. A high level of sensitivity to folks in the armed services, and also we did not feel that this was a significant private sector issue. In other words, the employers we represent largely do all they can to accommodate those returning back from their service work. So this is an issue that we're quite all right with, as is.
Great. Good to hear it. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department, and we, too, support the bill. I think you've heard all the fundamental values in it. I would just say that we're very excited about this because I think it does add a remedy at the state level that we haven't had before, and the only other remedy was the Department of Justice, basically the Federal Department of Justice, which has got a plate full as it is, and very, very rarely do you see one of these cases ever make it up there. The two incidents that we have experienced over the last 5 years that I can tell you right now were both public employers. We have not seen a lot of, very rarely have we seen difficulty in the private sector. And usually, and I'll turn it over to my good friend, Brigadier General Docker, who is a volunteer for the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve, and he can tell you a little bit about what they do, but I think he would validate that claim, is that generally speaking, the private employers are ignorant, perhaps, but once they get informed, they're very compliant and they do the work. But public employers seem to be a little more difficult to deal with. But in 5 years, two major cases, both of them public employees. One of them you probably read about was a Sherwood police chief up here, just north of here, and that ended up in a civil matter. But the point is that these things happen. They're rare, but they do happen. And now I think it gives us a remedy at the state level that will probably just eliminate even more of them. So I think it's a real, real good piece of legislation, and we're very, very supportive of it. Happy to answer any questions.
Thanks.
Good afternoon. I'm Bill Doctor, the chairman of the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve Committee in Oregon. We call it the ESGR. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll keep it very brief. The folks who have gone before covered most of it. Certainly, the ESGR is behind this bill. Are you familiar with the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve? If not, I'll give you an elevator speech that it's a volunteer organization. It goes down to the chain of command from the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reserve Affairs. There are 54 committees, all volunteers, and in fact, we do outreach on USERRA, Uniform Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act. USERRA goes all the way back to 1940. Various iterations come up. 2001 was the most current iteration. The other comment I would make is it's a somewhat cumbersome process for the Guardsmen or Reservists. We consider ourselves the white hats. We go out and talk to an employer and explain the Guardsmen or Reservists rights. 99 times out of 100, it is just a misinformation, and the employer says, absolutely, I'm behind you 100%. If, in fact, the 1% say, I disagree with you, then we can turn, or the Guardsman has an option of either dropping it or going through the Department of Justice vets program. At that point, we are out of it. We consider ourselves the white hats again. And they, in fact, reopen the case. We cannot pass on any information to them. They reopen the case. And they're the branch that can actually enforce USERRA. So all we can do is inform. The other thing I would say is, with the advent of the ADRA, Administrative Dispute Resolution Act, we do not have the names of employers for these Guardsmen and Reservists issues. That's kept private. We cannot pass this on to the Department of Justice. The other thing I would say is, while I'm in favor of this, I think you're going to have the same problem that we do, and that is awareness of the law. You can publish the law, but how do you get it out to the employers within the state? So that's an issue I think we're going to have to deal with.
Probably have you.
I could put on another hat.
Yeah.
So subject to your question, that concludes my comments.
Great. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay.
Thank
you very much.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 3256? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3256 and open a work session on House Bill 3256.
Madam Chair,
Senator
I
Comfort.
Move that House Bill 3256 be moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Telfer moves House Bill 3256 to the floor of the Senate with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, Pam, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Motion carries. And Sarah Volunteers would like to carry the bill?
I'll do it if you want.
How about Senator Telfer? Would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
Okay. I think we'll have Senator Telfer carry it, given your background with your family.
Mm-hmm. Thank
okay.
you.
Be honored. Excuse me. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3256. And we'll move on to the next bill, which is House Bill 2097, and open a public hearing. Jeremy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2097A, engrossed, allows Public Utility Commission, the PUC, to waive carrier of last resort's obligation to provide telecommunications services to a property with four or more residences within carrier's allocated territory when the property developer or owner has contracted exclusively with an alternative service provider. Provides process to allow the PUC to reinstate such obligation and directs that costs be borne equitably by customers of the property served. There's no revenue impact. There's a minimal fiscal impact, and no statement was issued. And in the House, there were 57 votes in favor and two excused.
And one nay.
And one nay.
No. Okay, thanks, Jeremy. And we have a few people signed up. So there actually are four, and we'll see if we can get you all up here together. Grant Wolf, Ginny Lang, Jim Green, and Lee Beyer. Good afternoon, and welcome to our committee. I don't think we've seen any of you here before.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association. The OTA represents mainly small, independent telephone companies that operate in rural parts of the state. The association asked for House Bill 2097 to address an issue that we are facing more and more frequently, and that is in regards to our carrier of last resort obligations. And basically that means when a territory, a geographic territory, is assigned to a telephone company or allocated by the Public Utility Commission, the carriers in that area or that have been assigned that territory are responsible for serving everybody in that territory. In recent years, with the advent of resort development and exclusive gated communities, and with competitive telecommunications carriers, the developer of that resort or subdivision can enter into an exclusive agreement for services, telecommunications services, and in effect freeze out the carrier with the obligation to serve outside the development. Despite that fact, the carrier still has the obligation to serve. This bill basically would allow that carrier to petition the Public Utility Commission for an exemption from our carrier of last resort obligation within the confines of that particular resort or subdivision. On the other side of the coin, if at some point in the future the citizens of that or residents of that subdivision feel the need or the need arises to have the carrier of last resort resume their obligation, they can petition the PUC for that as well. That's the bill in a nutshell. I know that's a high-level overview. I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody might have about this bill.
Okay, I think we'll take all the testimony and then open it up for questions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green representing Verizon. As Brad has outlined, we're supportive of this bill. It creates a process. Currently, there's not a process in place. I think Brad's explained that pretty well, that carriers are frozen out, and there's not an opportunity for carriers to either relieve themselves of that obligation of carrier of last resort or to get into that development. We support the idea of this process being in place, working with the PUC to make that application by a telecommunications provider. And then if in that development somebody says, well, wait a second, that person went bankrupt, they're not able to provide it, they can petition the PUC to then allocate that territory to a telecommunications provider. We believe this bill sets up a great process to deal with an issue. Although we haven't had to deal with it as a carrier, there are other carriers in the state that have had to deal with it. It's only a matter of time until it comes to our territory. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Lang. I represent Quest. My other two colleagues have covered all of the bases. I would say that we have had an experience like this in the state and in some of the other states that we serve across the western part of the United States. So our purpose in supporting this is to try to get ahead of a situation and make sure that we do have a process in place whereby we can go to the PUC and figure this out with them for our customers before there is a problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, Lee Beyer, Chair of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and I would just say that we have worked actually quite a bit, probably back to the time of the interim committee that Senator Rosenbaum served on when she was a House member. This issue came up. It is a thorny problem in trying to deal with this. It's the legacy issue of telephone regulation where companies get an assigned territory, and in trade for that assigned territory, they're expected to serve all the customers within it on request. Times have changed, and where we're at now, as Ms. Rolfe has explained, is we now have situations that are private developments, and the private developers are now looking at selling the right to provide telephone service as a profit center for them and locking out the incumbent because they have control of the private property. We support the bill because we think it's probably the best solution available to an unfortunate situation going forward. But I'd be remiss if I didn't advise the legislature that there are some potential problems down the road with this. You have a situation, I guess I would, something that people would be familiar with is Sun River or a resort like that where people buy into it and all of a sudden they have a package of services, but down the road they become disenchanted with that carrier there and they're trying to get somebody else in a Quest. They would turn to a Quest if they had the assigned territory and say, we have a right to get a service from you, and they can't get in. They can't get that service, and your constituent becomes very unhappy about that and calls us. The other situation that could arise, and in fact, there's some that are sort of on the edge of this in some of the coastal developments now, is you buy into a property and the provider doesn't have the wherewithal of one of our established telephone companies, and they go out of business, and the customers are stuck, if you will, there. They've got a system that goes in their place and no one else is there. And I'd contrast the system that we have. If we were talking about a regular subdivision, the requirement under state law for a developer of a subdivision is the developer has to provide either an open trench or conduit so that the telephone company or whatever utility can come in and provide services. In these private developments, that's not there. So you have the problem of big communities, some of them, 1,200, 1,800 lots, and how does a Quest or a Verizon get to the middle of that development if the developer doesn't let them in? So it's problematic. I just wanted to advise you that there isn't an easy answer to it. I think this one is the best one we could come up with, and I think it serves everybody's interest. But you may hear about problems down the road as these come up. Our other alternative, to be frank, that I actually favored was requiring that these private developments have the same requirements as subdivisions, but there's problems with that too, private property rights. So there's not an easy way to answer the question. That's where we are.
Okay. Thanks for your testimony. Questions? Senator Prezonsky.
Thanks. Lee, I just was going to ask you, because some of the proponents came by and explained to me the bill. I understand that it went through a situation in the House from the original bill that had the, I guess, the process that the carrier would be able to petition, and then the PUC would actually have the requirement to take the obligation off of the carrier of last resort. And then when I look at the engrossed version, which would be that they still have the right to petition, but then it's discretionary with the PUC to whether they should be released from their obligation of that area where there's that private development, and the private developer or the owners entered into some contract with another provider of the service, it seems to me that we're setting up more work for everybody in this place, plus there's no certainty that the carrier of last resort is going to be freed from their obligation. And it just seems to me that if we're let's say, hamstrung by it being private property that's involved, if they've entered into a contract, they should be obligated under that contract. And it seems unfair from my perspective that the carrier of last resort is still kind of hanging out there, that they may have to someday get in there to provide service to one or two people because they become disgruntled with the contract that they bought into when they purchased their property.
That's a, Madam Chair, Senator Prezonsky, that's a fair description, and that's a fair concern about it. It's just you're into some legacy issues here of you still have territorial allocations and the law that goes with that, and so this gives us a process to relieve that. I don't think we're really assigning the territory to the other carrier under this. Brant could correct me if I state that wrong. I think we're just recognizing that it's there and providing some level of consumer protection, although it's not a lot. I'm going to be very honest with it. You know, if somebody could come forth, and you should think about this, and let me sidestep. The way I've been thinking about this is from the process that the commission has had to deal with small, rural, predominantly rural water companies where, you know, people bought into it, suddenly they come disgruntled and you have, you know, a large percentage of the people who want something else. And so we're just trying to provide an avenue for doing that, but I recognize that the commission in dealing with these, it'd be very difficult. And it may be, and we do it, there is a public benefits test in there where it's in their interest that we would be measuring that. So I guess in sum, we're just trying to provide the opportunity for Oregon citizens to have that choice that everybody else has.
Follow-up, Senator?
Yeah, I do want to follow up. And I guess I'm trying to figure out, I understand the consumer part, but it seems to me it's buyer beware. The buyer's buying into a private development. That developer saying, we have this package for you, or it's going to be somewhere in the fine print that says this is who's going to be providing your services for phone and whatever other packages that are there. And to me, that private contract has, in fact, let's say, banished or prohibits the carrier of last resort from going in there because there's this contract that's been entered into by the developer and whoever is the provider for services there. And it just seemed, I mean, if the bill said that they shall be exempted and then still have the process to allow those who are disgruntled to either go to court and break the contract with the owner, the developer, and or somehow petition to PUC saying the provider's not providing us at the level of service that's required, that's the part that seems unfair because the carrier of last resort is somehow going to kind of be out there not knowing if they're ever going to have to go in, and if they have to go in, what steps do they have to take to actually provide the service, and will it be limited to a few within, or is it going to be with the whole amount? And then do they have to bargain for whatever infrastructure that's in place, or that's the part that doesn't seem to be fair, that we would say that as much as we want to protect a consumer, that they have already made a choice by purchasing into that property knowing what the limitations are.
That's a perspective.
Madam Chair. Senator Manis Anderson was next.
It's a follow to it, Senator Brzezinski.
Okay, so was mine.
So was mine too. That's where I was going to. And if you look at the bill on the back side, starting with line five, as I read the bill, it means that upon petition from any interested person located within the property for which the commission has waived the carrier of last resort, if they want to change, then they're able to do that. Isn't that what that's saying? It really requires the reinstatement of the carrier of last resort obligations. Then the commission has the power to assign the obligations to a telecommunications utility. Could you explain that piece? Because I think that's addressing...
Madam Chair, Senator Manis Anderson, yes, that's correct. That is what that language says. We had not a lengthy conversation, but a discussion yesterday at the Public Utility Commission regarding this language, whether or not one person could compel the commission to kind of reestablish that carrier of last resort obligation. And the conclusion was that there was a public convenience and necessity test that would have to be met so that one person wouldn't be able to compel that, but maybe some test, 30%, 40%, 50%, something like that, would be able to go to the commission and say the quality of service has deteriorated to the point that we need this, or the company's gone bankrupt, or what have you. So I don't know if that helps you or not.
Well, yeah, it means I interpreted the section correctly, but then where does PUC come in if there are, say, maybe a half a dozen people out of 100 that really are very dissatisfied? That's a subjective decision that PUC makes then?
If I may, Madam Chair, Senator Manis Anderson, I don't think it's subjective. I mean, there's a public convenience and necessity test. I don't know how you set that bar, but I think that working with staff, the industry would probably be able to come up with appropriate rules so that it wouldn't be that subjective. There would be a reasonable standard or test that would have to be met.
Madam Chair, Senator Manis Anderson, it's not something that's unusual for the commission to do. It's a little bit unusual here, but making the needs and necessities determination is something that PUCs do all the time.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what Senator Brzezinski was getting at is a really interesting issue, which is when a property owner enters into one of these contracts, we as a state set up a public policy that in the public good there are carriers of last resort. Okay, so we've provided that protection to all property owners in the state that there is a carrier out there that's going to handle your service. But when a property owner then enters into a contract excluding that carrier of last resort, intentionally excluding that carrier of last resort, it seems like to me that the state is then relieved of its obligation to provide a carrier of last resort, and therefore, in essence, the property owner should have no additional future benefit by the PUC coming back in and saying, okay, carriers, you've got to be the carrier of last resort here. I mean, it seems like that once you've signed that contract, you've in essence said, okay, we're waiving our right to have a carrier of last resort, and therefore the current carrier of last resort is waived by that contract, and then if the property owners inside that want to have service provided, they should have to provide some kind of new contract with whatever carrier is willing to service that area. Do you see what I'm saying? Why go through this process? Because they have, in essence, opted out of the public protection by entering into that contract.
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator George, you raise a point. As Senator Brzezinski said, it's sort of a buyer beware. I think... And perhaps we're going a little over the top on consumer protection here, and that's really a policy call for you to make. tends to be that people get into these things and they don't understand all the stuff. You're buying a house at, you know, Black Butte, and it's a wonderful big thing. You didn't think about, is there any telephone service there, and am I going to be happy with it or not? And the same thing, is there any gas service there? Is there any electrical service? The legislature in the past has set standards for that, and we're dealing with those legacy issues of do you want to step away from that? What this bill does is I think it tries to strike a compromise, if you will. It recognizes those private decisions that have been made, but it provides a way back in cases where things have just kind of fallen apart. And I would say, and perhaps the commission has been a little overly protective here, but from our experience, and again, it's primarily some of these water developments, and that there's been some real problems. We're in litigation over a couple of them now where we've got the majority of the owners in the middle of a suit that have drawn the state into the middle of that. And whether we like it or not, that's kind of the role that the legislature has casted, and we are your agents in dealing with your constituents' issues in this kind of situation. You certainly have the right to change that. You're the body that are elected to make those decisions.
I guess the question comes to is, let's go through the scenario. One of these companies that we've talked about here is offering to be the carrier of last resort. The private development decides that they don't want that carrier. They're going to go with some other carrier. They go with the other carrier. That carrier doesn't provide good service. Okay. Under this bill, who's then responsible for drilling wires or hanging wires or doing whatever's necessary to service those people who are no longer served? It seems like to me the unfairness of this whole thing is that if you take any one of these folks up here, you make their company go back and retroactively drill in wires that they could have put in for a fraction of the cost at the original development. That's completely unfair to those companies, and the cost should be borne by the private property owner who opted out of that opportunity to begin with. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's really who's going to bear the burden of that?
Madam Chair, Senator George, I understand where you're going with that. Understand what would likely happen than this. Yes, the company would have to go in and pull the wires to make the service. The customer who requested it will pay for that.
Okay. That's what I was trying to get at.
And there is language in the bill that allows the commission to allocate the cost.
Thank you.
So, yeah. Yes, Senator Brzezinski?
Madam Chair, I guess, Lee, I don't know if this is something that you're ready to... I'm not sure what went on in negotiations as to getting to the compromise language, but I'm comfortable with the dash A's. I'd be much more comfortable if we changed one word on line 13 of page 1 where it says may to shall. And the purpose of that, from my perspective, would allow the carrier of last resort to know that they're out from any obligation for that private property area that's under contract, and unless the people come back under the other portions of the bill under page 2, line 5, where they petition and ask for the carrier of last resort or some other carrier to come in there and take over. And that at least would seem equitable, recognizing on the front end that the carrier of last resort does not have to be... And I don't know what they have to do in anticipation. Are we going to have to come in and take over this service? Maybe that's going to still be there no matter what, but at least it seems like at the front end, they know they're not obligated or needing to worry about it unless the people within that development or the owner who entered into the original contract wants to do something different. So...
Madam Chair, our Senator Brzezinski, I don't think that's a big problem with that. And that's kind of, frankly, the way we were thinking about it anyway.
Okay.
I guess the only thing that would be there is if something unusual came up. We, you know, as a cautionary, we usually like the maze in case something that, you know, we didn't think about or you didn't think about in passing the law comes up, that we have some flexibility there. But I think that's the intent, at least as we've talked about it, would be a shell.
So, if I may, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So, understanding how these developments are, let's say, being created wherever they are in the state, it sounds like what I'm hearing is that the PUC would see if the carrier of last resort filed their petition knowing that they've been, let's say, excluded from that area, that it would be the practice of the PUC to release them of that obligation. So as long as, well, once they've entered their petition to be released from that obligation, unless there are some overwhelming, compelling reason that would need to be, I guess, somehow noted, that that's why it was, would be denied?
Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, that's the way I'm thinking about it. My only worry here, and it's not really a worry, it's just at what point we would deal with that. I mean, I'm thinking of a situation I was just talking with one of the telephone companies about in the coast where the project was started, but we got to the end and frankly went bankrupt before anything was done. Had they come in early and said, and if this was a shell and says exempt it now, as I understand what you're saying, we would have to grant that, and then we may find before the project was developed that it went gunny bag and sort of in a quandary of what would we do at that point. But that all's probably workable. I'm just trying to be very open and sharing the thoughts on that.
Yeah, and I'm too. I'm just trying to figure out what's equitable at the beginning. I understand that, you know, if you have one of those situations, the way the A and Gross is written, that the owner, or if there were people that had purchased into it, I guess the question is, were lines even set or not? I mean, it may be pretty easy to back out, but I'm just trying to figure out.
And I suspect that the telephone companies probably wouldn't come in and ask for that. They know if they won a bid or lost a bid to provide service, and they probably wouldn't rush in to do that.
So
I'm guessing.
That's my thoughts. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, thanks. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2097? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2097. Members, are we ready to move the bill?
Well, does the senator want
senator
to change
Pruszynski?
The word or not?
I mean, I'm comfortable with this language because I do think there are a couple of provisions in here. There should be the possibility that in some circumstances they wouldn't approve it. So I think that's the reason why it may make sense, although it's clear from their testimony and the record, I think, has been pretty clear that they would approve it. So there would have to be something pretty exceptional. And then in terms of the cost, I think that cost allocation language, too, does provide that they can take care of the problem that Senator George raised.
Right. No, I appreciate that. I understand that the A's have the recourse of getting back into it. It just, I mean, from the perspective of, you know, from a business perspective, it seems like if I've been outed, then I shouldn't have to sit there thinking I'm going to have to come back in. But I also understand that if that's how the PUC is going to pretty well operate, then that tells me that we're going to be able to, you know, we'll revisit this in the future if that doesn't seem to be the case.
I mean, we had the association, we had the providers supporting the bill, so I would assume they're comfortable with it.
Okay, let's move it out.
And I'm seeing heads nodding, so let's open a work session on House Bill 2097.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2097A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
And Senator Telfer moves House Bill 2097 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, Pam, please call the roll.
Senator
George.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a volunteer to carry this on the floor? Okay. Unless anyone else wants to. Okay, Senator Pruszynski will carry it. Okay, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2097. Pam, if you could please call Representative Matthews' office, I think he wants to testify on the next bill. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2963A. Is he on his way? Okay. Jeremy, do you want to tell us about this bill?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the easiest one of my entire session. House Bill 2963A prohibits deputy district attorneys from striking. There's no revenue impact,
Their fiscal statement has been issued. You have that in your packet. And the House vote was 57 aye, 2 against, and 1 excused.
Are we missing something here?
I don't have the summary sheet for some reason.
You don't have the staff measure summary?
Yeah.
Oh.
But that might sure we can mean get that I don't have it somewhere.
We have an extra copy of that?
Yeah.
Looks like it's on its way.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Jeremy, for that explanation. We have two people signed up to testify, and I'll call them both. How about Representative Matthews and Joe Basler?
I've seen that representative here before.
Yeah, welcome back.
We actually traded while he was over here testifying,
oh, is that right?
And I was over testifying in the other committee. And
how about that? Like a tag team.
We could have stayed in our respective committees and just presented each other's
there you go.
Bills.
Could have probably
we would have missed you. Okay, go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, members of the Senate Committee, my name is Greg Matthews, for the record. I'm the State Representative of House District 50 of the great city of Gresham. Here today to testify.
Amen.
Little shout out. Here to testify in favor of House Bill 2963A. With me today, Joe Basler, who you all know and love from AFSCME. This bill is one of those bills that at first glance people were kind of thinking, like, you know, really? Is this needed? But when you really think about the fundamental basics of what we're trying to do here, and that is that the bill would prohibit deputy district attorneys from striking. Quite honestly, in looking into the bill, deputy district attorneys right now would have a real dilemma, morally and ethically, in striking as well. This bill places them in the same category as our police officers, firefighters, and select other few. I think transit, I think our bus workers are in that as well, which would make it unlawful to strike a recognized picket line of a labor organization while in performance of official duties. When we consider the narrow set of circumstances that a district attorney or deputy district attorney may be allowed to strike, it seemed in the best interest of all, including our communities, first and foremost, that the we'd give them access to the binding interest arbitration. I guess, simply put, we were trying to, you know, really keep it in scope. And as a former police officer, it wouldn't be rare to encounter deputy district attorney early in a case and work with that same district attorney throughout the process, all the way from start to prosecution. And with that being said, I would hate to see the break of chain of command in that due to a strike of any kind. Aside from that as well, you know, binding interest arbitration kind of keeps the community in mind where these folks stay continuously at work, allowing the mediation process to take place and potentially arbitration. We heard in our committee some testimony from a rural community deputy district attorney that was talking about the recruitment and retention problems in those rural communities and some of those situations. But first and foremost, we thought that it would be real rare and perhaps ethically and morally irresponsible and impossible for deputy DAs to strike, and that's why we created this bill that would move them in the same category of police and firefighters.
Okay, thank you. Joe?
I think Representative Matthews said it very well. My name is Joe Basler with Oregon AFSCME. We brought this bill to the good representative. We represent a few deputy district attorneys, Hood River, Clatsop, Umatilla County, to name most of them. There is a bar opinion that says that public interest or public employee attorneys can ethically strike, and I've attached it there, under a set of circumstances, which include having readily available replacement attorneys. Rural areas, that just doesn't exist. There's no way another attorney can step in on, say, a homicide case, a rape case, and sort of fill in while our members go on strike. And frankly, our members find that immoral. I mean, they freak out at the very concept of leading one of their cases, their babies, alone while they have a labor dispute. And I think we just really, we think it puts us in line with the other parts of the public safety system, and would ask you to help us. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your testimony. Any questions? Yes, Senator Przanski.
I'm sorry, these are a couple bills today. I'm tickled when I look at the original bill as to then what the amendment is. So, anyone want to tell me why the assistant attorney generals are out of the bill?
The attorney general's office was very concerned. I was not exactly excited about the amendment, but they were very concerned that it would split their department, and also because a lot of the attorneys there, we represent them also, have less of a public safety focus. A lot of them are give advice to state agencies. In fact, only a very small number of the attorneys there have a public safety focus, and I think that was the Attorney General's issue.
And so, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, if I could.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, as the chief sponsor of the bill, I sense with having objection, I didn't want to lose this opportunity on this bill in a battle to cover a few that perhaps didn't fall into the same category as deputy district attorneys. And that would just be, my opinion as chief sponsor, thinking that rather than go down a rocky road and perhaps have a lot of opposition from few and risk dividing a group that was feeling as if they didn't, and these were employees were as well in agreement that they didn't necessarily were seeking this, rather than force this upon them, we adjusted it to the deputy district attorneys.
Okay. Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. By giving up this right to strike, is there any financial or any other remuneration that's would be considered by giving up a right to get something in return?
Well, Joe Basler again would ask me. What would happen is we had the normal contract negotiations, and at some point, if they were to break down on a few issues, we would then we would ask the Employee Relations Board to present a list of arbiters, and each side, the management and the union side, would sort of keep taking one off until they get down to one neutral arbiter, and then we would present offers on the disputed issues, which is, from our perspective, is usually only one or two. I can't speak for everybody, but in the past, it's been one or two issue that have come down we couldn't decide on, and that arbiter would look at both offers and take and decide. So when they say that the fiscal is indeterminate, it really is, because it's not a windfall for either side. It comes down to an arbitration process. Does that make sense?
That's the binding interest arbitration process.
Right. There's a whole section.
I wanted to get that
cleared. Basically what we're doing is we're taking away that right to strike, but they're also guaranteed binding arbitration, which we've had numerous bills over the sessions dealing with how that works and last best, blah, blah, blah.
And Madam Chair, if I could, again, Greg Matthews. I'm the president of the Gresham Firefighters. I'm also the chief negotiator with our contracts with the city, and we fall into this binding interest arbitration. I've been very proud to report we have great labor management relations. Happy to say that we haven't had to go to an arbitration hearing, since I've been there. We do resolve quite a bit in mediation where that gets done. I think I'm most proud of the fact, though, that when there are contract disputes, service is never interrupted to the community, and that's what we'd be doing with this bill as well, keeping the service provided to the community and keeping the criminal justice system intact.
Okay, I think my favorite thing in your testimony, Joe, is the line that people would be worried that their replacements might not be competent and trained enough not to screw up the cases.
That's a direct quote
really
from one of my members.
In any of his testimony before. That's a technical term, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I don't see any other questions. I guess you've answered them all, so thank you.
Thank you for your time.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2963A and open a work session on House Bill 2963A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2963A to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Telfer moves House Bill 2963A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Pam, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. Since I'm a sponsor of the bill, I think I'll carry it. And seeing nothing further to come before us today, members, we are adjourned.
Yay.